This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. You can watch the NHL playoffs this weekend, but chances are you won't hear a goal call quite as much fun as this one. Neck. 11 seconds is all it took during last year's Stanley Cup Finals to put hockey announcer Harnarayan Singh on the map. But getting to that moment took his family generations. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
It was snowing when Harnarayan Singh's father arrived in Canada in 1966. It was June. Suntok Singh was from India. He'd never seen snow. He and his wife were willing to put up with cold weather for what they thought would be a better life. Suntok had secured a job as a teacher in a small town in Alberta. He'd interviewed over the phone. When he showed up at the school, the principal said,
"You're wearing a turban and you have a beard," and it was basically thanks but no thanks.
So Singh's father scrambled to find another job. There was one town that would take him, Brooks, Alberta, population 3,000.
They were in a big-time need for teachers. The year before, the entire staff had quit over a dispute with the administration, so they readily accepted my dad.
Brooks, Alberta was an odd place for the couple to end up. There were no other Sikhs, and the town was on its way to becoming one of Canada's biggest beef processors. The Singhs were vegetarian. Suntok knew to expect some bigotry. His own grandfather had tried to start a new life in Canada back in 1908, and the locals made it clear he wasn't welcome. His grandfather returned to India. But the Singhs stayed put. Suntok's wife, Surjeet, also worked as a teacher. Suntok became the high school's lone calculus instructor. They started a family, and in 1984, their fourth child came along, Harnarayan. By then, Brooks's population had ballooned to 10,000. The Singhs were still the only Sikhs. They spoke Punjabi at home. And from his very first day of kindergarten, Harnarayan Singh wore a formal adult-style turban to school. He wanted to look just like his dad. At recess one day, a classmate pulled off his turban. Singh burst into tears. He kept wearing his turban to school, and he found a way to fit in.
Like a lot of my pictures from elementary school, I'm wearing hockey sweaters, and I almost very early figured out that the questions about the differences in my appearance, they were put by the wayside when we just talked about hockey, and I became kind of just one of the other kids.
Singh never actually played ice hockey, but embracing the game wasn't an act. His favorite player was Wayne Gretzky. When the NHL star's birthday rolled around, Singh made sure his family celebrated it just like he was one of their own, with a Sikh prayer and a sweet pudding called Parshad. And Singh loved to watch games on TV in his living room.
And I would run around kind of emulating the players, but as I was emulating the players with my mini hockey sticks and the hockey balls, I would also be commentating the game and providing crowd noise and all sorts of stuff. My family realized that I was interested in the announcing side of it, so they proceeded to give me this toy microphone and a stand from Radio Shack, and that was just like, they had a little speaker and the mic and everything, and that for me was just the perfect toy.
Growing up, Singh told folks in town that he wanted to become an NHL announcer, and some of his neighbors were quick to dismiss him. Singh still remembers a conversation he and his father had with the family doctor. After he learned about Singh's broadcasting dream, the doctor said, "You have to be realistic. Nobody who looks like you is on TV."
And yeah, I went home and I was kind of, it made me think too, that is this even like, am I just dreaming? Like, does this even make sense?
Singh figured his dad, a guy with 7 advanced degrees, fond of saying stuff like, "You can't BS a calculus test," would agree that it was time to get serious. But later that day,
I think my dad could tell that I was a little down in the dumps and said, "What's wrong? Like, are you thinking about what was talked about today?" And then I said, "Yeah, well," I was like, "maybe I should be more realistic." But surprisingly, at that time, my dad said, "Well, you should go for what your passion is."
So Singh went to broadcasting school, got a job as a local news reporter for a radio station in Calgary. He tried to pitch his editors on as many hockey stories as possible. after a couple years, he didn't feel he was getting any closer to becoming an on-air broadcaster. He even thought about switching careers and enrolled in real estate and mortgage courses. Then, one day in 2008, he was at his desk, and
lo and behold, I get this call from Joel Darling, executive producer, Hockey Night in Canada in Toronto. I'd heard the name, but never even thought I would talk to somebody so high up within the Hockey Night in Canada family. He said, "Your name has come up. We are thinking of doing Hockey Night in Canada in Punjabi." And I'm kind of like, is this even real? Like, I never imagined that there would be a Punjabi broadcast of Hockey Night in Canada. But there we go. I, of course, accepted it before even understanding kind of what all of it was.
A few weeks later, Singh was in a studio in Toronto calling the 2008 Stanley Cup Finals in Punjabi. The broadcasts were a success. Turns out, after English and French, Punjabi is Canada's third most highly spoken language. And soon after, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation decided to make Punjabi broadcasts a Saturday night fixture. And they wanted Singh to be the play-by-play guy. The problem was, the Toronto studio was 1,600 miles from Singh's home in Calgary. And the gig didn't pay enough for him to quit his day job and move, especially for one night a week of work on a show that might not last very long. But
look, this was my dream. I couldn't give it up. So I just said, don't worry, I'll be there, without even knowing how I would figure that out.
Singh concocted a plan. He'd work a normal week in Calgary, and then
I would take the red-eye flight Friday. I would get there Saturday early morning, and I would rent a car. I'd go to the CBC in Toronto, do my prep for the two games that we were going to call. And the games would finish at 1 a.m. Eastern.
Singh couldn't afford to stay in a hotel every week. So after the game,
I would just drive back to the airport and try to find some benches to lay on.
Singh learned where to find the benches without the armrests. And he learned to tie his bags to his leg so they wouldn't get stolen. Then he'd take the first flight out of Toronto.
And I'd arrive in Calgary at 9:30, and my sister would pick me up, and we'd go straight to the temple.
Singh did this every weekend, and he kept it all a secret from the Hockey Night Punjabi producers. He paid his own travel expenses. A couple years in, he started feeling tired all the time. He went to a doctor who said the crazy schedule had probably done damage to his body. Ever since, Singh has had to take thyroid medication. But Singh was finally getting to call NHL games. And as the show grew, things got better for Singh. The studio itself was moved west, first to Calgary, then Vancouver. And in 2012, Singh left his weekday reporting job. It's now been nearly 10 years since Singh started calling NHL games in Punjabi, and he and his crew have a devoted following. They spice up their calls with references to Punjabi foods, poetry, and music.
You know, for example, if a team has a really bad period, we'll throw in that they need a cup of chai tea in the intermission to get going.
But the call that changed Singh's life was the one from last year's Stanley Cup Finals, when Pittsburgh Penguins center Nick Bonino scored a game-winning goal in Game 1. The call went viral. More hockey fans learned about Singh in the Punjabi broadcasts. This season, Singh's been taking on more responsibilities. In November, on top of his regular Hockey Night Punjabi duties, he worked a Leafs Flames game as a ringside reporter for a Sportsnet national broadcast. That made Harnarayan Singh the first Sikh to broadcast an NHL game in English.
It's really special. It makes me feel emotional that we've come such a long way as a community, but also as a family since my parents first came here so long ago. And it's really, they had to go through the challenges. I mean, I'm getting to do the fun stuff here.
Fun stuff, sure, but also important. Because now when Sikh kids say they want careers in broadcasting, nobody can tell them there's no one on TV who looks like them. For Only a Game, I'm Martin Kessler.
The occasion was a birthday. A friend was turning 70. His wife was staging his party at an indoor racetrack, a place where you put on a race driver's suit and helmet and zoom around a curvy course trying not to slam into one of the big rubber protective barriers or somebody else's car. When they responded to their invitations, the wisest guest said they'd not be driving. I was not among the wisest guests. So there I was, jammed into a noisy little machine, my backside inches from the surface of the track. We roared off in heats. Each competitor's best time would flash in red bulbs on a big electronic scoreboard. The top six finishers, identified by their initials, would qualify for the final heat. The bottom six finishers would watch. Some of the racers were the birthday boy's nephews and nieces. Their knees didn't hurt, and they knew they would never die. From among their number, there would emerge a champion. But if I could beat some of the other old fools, I might qualify for that championship lap. What a stupid thing to worry about, I thought to myself, but I only thought it for a moment because the guy with the green flag was waving it and checking his phone. We were off, some of us with glory on our minds. I wanted to get a feel for the twisting course, so I drove cautiously for a few seconds, and then I saw an opening between two cars and jammed the pedal to the floor, and behind me the engine roared like an angry lawnmower. I passed some people, and some people passed me, and around and up and then down and around we sped. One or two drivers got stuck against one of the barriers. Amateurs, I thought. When the heats had been completed, the drivers who'd only dawdled around the course for a lark knew their work was done, and they took off their helmets and stepped aside. I looked at the scoreboard. I tried to pretend I didn't care whether or not I would race again, and then my initials appeared glowing on the column of lights, and I felt a witless jolt of satisfaction. Oh, man, I said to somebody, my back is not going to like getting into that car again one bit. But that was rubbish. The excellent birthday cake and ice cream wouldn't have tasted nearly as good as they did if I hadn't qualified. Charles Farrell used to manage boxers.
I fixed a lot of fights over the years. I covered my tracks very well. And the statute of limitations, of course, has long since run.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. Minnetonka Paul recently left the following review of Only a Game on iTunes. I have been listening to this show since it started because it was on at 6 a.m. on Saturdays here in Minnetonka, Minnesota, and I had small children. I went through the trouble of putting an automatic timer on my boombox each week to record the show. Am I dating myself? Yes. But the show is that good. These podcasts sure are a lot easier to use. Now more than ever, I need the entertainment. Thanks, Minnetonka Paul. I, too, remember the days of the boombox, and I also remember the days of the 8-track tape and the days of the Victrola. Never mind. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It's the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NBA's conference semifinals are about to get underway, and so we begin this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know with basketball, and then we'll get to some sports that are less popular with the millennials. Joining me are Will Leach of Sports on Earth via Skype and Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports. Hello, guys.
Hey, what's going on?
Hello, sir.
Michael, I want you to start. You're the guy who's bringing us basketball this week.
All right. Well, the relationship between athletes and journalists has always been a little tenuous, mainly because athletes often feel that journalists are given too much power in terms of getting out their message or they're providing their image to the public. But now we have another predicament that may lead to an even deeper split. The NBA has a new rule that could cost players up to $75 to $80 million. The league wanted to come up with a policy that would hinge player contracts on basic results. So if you make a defensive player of the year or you make one of the three All-NBA teams, you can get more money. And they put that in the hands of a panel of 100 media members deciding whether a player is going to make one of the three All-NBA teams. And a player who has a lot hinging on the results of this last All-NBA vote is Paul George with the Indiana Pacers. Can you imagine looking at someone who cost you $80 million? It might make for an uncomfortable conversation.
But it would be a very comfortable conversation if a media member helped Paul George make $75 million. Let's not forget that either. It's funny. This has actually been one of my big hobby horses for a long time has been about Baseball Hall of Fame voting, and that it's done by the baseball writers. And it does seem strange. I feel like the job of a journalist, not to get all very serious Fourth Estate guy on you here, but it feels like our job is to watch what happens and talk about or write about or broadcast what happens and not involve what happens. And to me, I think the right way to do as a media member is to say, you know what, I'm going to respond to this by not actually voting for this at all, so they don't have to yell at me or they don't have to think that they're trying to bribe me.
You know, this all makes me think about a friend of mine years ago who bragged that he was not somebody who'd ever been corrupted. He's not somebody who had sold out. And I can say the same thing. As a member of the media, I have not sold out. Of course, it's also true that nobody has called me and asked me to sell out, because then it would just be a matter of determining the price.
Yeah.
This is an astonishingly silly thing, as far as I'm concerned. And Michael, you go ahead and wrap it up.
The other interesting aspect of this is that there is transparency with the vote, so you will know exactly who voted for you. You're going to see some really grumpy guys when they realize who cost them a lot of money.
Will, I'm going to ask you to rescue us from this swamp of billions of dollars at stake and get us into baseball, please. It's baseball season. Let's go.
Well, when you think of the great quotes throughout baseball history, every generation kind of gets its one for its own time. I am the luckiest man, must be the luckiest man on earth. It ain't over till it's over. Well, Eric Thames, first baseman for the Milwaukee Brewers, who's off to one of the best starts in baseball, came up with a true quote for our times last week. Asked after the game, after he hit another home run, he has 11 home runs leading baseball. They asked him, hey, have you heard anything about these PED? Because he came from Korea. He spent all these years in Korea. He's come back and has taken the league by storm and has caused people, including two players for the Chicago Cubs, to actually question whether he is on PEDs. So here's what Eric Thames said. I have lots of blood and urine. Now, that is the quote. What he was saying was, test me all you want. He's already been tested twice this year. Now, truly, what better way to sum up the last 20 years of baseball conversation than the star player? The great story. Like, think about what Eric Thames has done. You know, he really struggled 5 years ago. He left. He went to Korea, and he learned something there. He became a great home run hitter. But we are still stuck in this archaic thinking of 20 years ago that – people that you hit home runs are using PEDs. If you look at the last five people that have been busted for PEDs, three of them are stolen base passers who don't hit homers. Two of them are middle relievers. All we can do is pepper him with so many, are you using? Are you using? Are you using this? Are you using this? This is why we can't have nice things.
Honestly, you know how I feel about PEDs. I'm like, if you can take them, fine. I don't care. Just entertain me. But if you are clean, we've been so cynical now that we can't just appreciate greatness. And it's also a big problem with baseball in general, where it seems like ever since the steroid era, there's been this lack of promotion of its stars.
I'm with you, Will. First of all, I want to thank you for publicizing this great quote for our times. And I agree with you. It's perfect. And like you, I prefer to assume the best of people. And I will assume the best of Eric Thames until he is disgraced and suspended and led away in handcuffs.
In that case, please delete this recording.
All right, guys. We're going to move on now to golf. The U.S. Golf Association has determined that people watching a golf tournament on TV should not be officiating. And that may seem obvious because people watching golf on TV are probably half asleep. Anyway, apparently because a viewer called and pointed out that LPGA player Lexi Thompson had replaced her golf ball an inch away from where she had marked it, Ms. Thompson was penalized in a tournament earlier this month. Now the USGA has said that henceforth, quote, players should not be held to the degree of precision that video technology can provide. That there should have to be such a rule, declaring that TV viewers shouldn't be calling the shots in a tournament, seems absurd, but that's golf. Anyway, I'm glad that if the USGA was going to make a call in this particular situation, at least they made the right one. Does anybody want to stand up for those sitting down and watching TV with their phones in their hands?
I do.
Well, make your case, please.
Well, I mean, we've been kind of conditioned to have instant replay. We always want to have the right call. So if a golfer is not, you know, adhering to the rules and golf doesn't have the means to check it, then why not have the fans at home just call it in and make sure we get the thing right? We don't want to have people cheating and where they place the ball.
Wait a minute. One inch from the marker is where the ball went back.
That inch could make a big difference.
Yeah, it does. It's golf.
It's obvious to me, Michael, that you are not familiar with the kind of basic spine of golf, which is that the players are honest and they call penalties on themselves.
Yes.
And we don't need to have people calling in to correct what they perceive as terrible injustices.
The part I find fascinating about this is the USGA basically saying, well, we don't think that the players should have to adhere to the scrutiny of what video can give, which is basically an argument against instant replay in all sports. I have to say, I'm one of those people that, as replay has become a larger part of our games, is starting to lose faith in its utility. I think it works, but we've all had that point where we're watching a game and we're like, oh, good, instant replay is going to get this right. And then they don't overturn the call, which means we have the same frustration that we had before we had instant replay, and now it costs us 5 minutes. And to me, I feel like the replay culture has taken over sports now to the point that finally, you know what, to those brave golfers, and yes, I said it, brave golfers who stand up in the way of replay creep, I say good for you. Move that ball an inch. I don't know why. Go ahead. Do whatever you need to. And don't worry about Big Brother.
This is terrible. I love replay.
My guest for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Michael Lee of Yahoo Sports and Will Leach of Sports on Earth. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
It's been good.
I fixed a lot of fights over the years.
That's Charles Farrell, and he can say he fixed a lot of fights over the years without worrying about the consequences because
I covered my tracks very well, and the statute of limitations, of course, has long since run.
Farrell says the art of fixing a fight is often more subtle than, kid, this ain't your night, a wink and a paper sack full of cash.
I mean, after all, what we're talking about is illegal. So you don't need to get into specific language. What you'll do is you'll talk about a fighter that you'll have who needs to stay busy.
Stay busy means win. Everybody knows that.
So the other guy knows that you need someone to lose to your fighter, and he'll say, I've got somebody who's in the gym, but not much lately. He's not in great shape. Okay, so now we're talking about somebody who's probably not going to go the distance. The response to that is, that's okay, I only need 3 or 4 rounds of work. And the other guy will say, okay, well, my guy's only good for 3 rounds. And you can fine-tune without ever saying, I want this fight to be fixed. But the fight is as fixed as it can be, and you will get exactly what you want.
If you're surprised to hear that's the way the business of prize fighting gets done, Charles Farrell says you've got company.
I don't think it's widely known. People don't want to believe this, of course not. And they don't want to feel that they've been fooled and cheated. But they have been.
So now you know how a result gets arranged before the alleged contest begins. Maybe it's time for a story about how that can happen even after the contest ends. The cast of this little drama, which transpired 20-odd years ago, includes Farrell, of course, and a former heavyweight champion.
Well, Leon Spinks was a man who was, at that point, about 40 years old, and he had never taken care of himself. And I understood that his value as a fighter, if in fact there was any value to him at this stage as a fighter, was as an opponent for other fighters.
Against his better judgment, Farrell took on the task of managing Spinks. After all, Leon had once beaten Muhammad Ali. Maybe his name could still draw a crowd, and if Farrell could get him a couple of wins and create the illusion of a comeback, maybe it could draw a big crowd. He arranged a match with a guy named Eddie Curry, whom Farrell describes as a fellow who could fight a little, if nobody told him not to.
He would fight anyone. And he would generally be knocked out in the first round. And I assumed that Leon could beat him.
Unhappily for Farrell and Spinks, Eddie Curry assumed otherwise. In fact, he lasted 8 rounds, and he outboxed Spinks in most of them. And since Eddie's understanding was that he'd signed up for an 8-round fight, when the bell rang to end the 8th, he returned to his corner and held out his hands so the corner man could remove his gloves.
Eddie Curry won a unanimous decision. It was announced in the center of the ring.
And that would have been the end of Leon Spinks as a draw if Charles Farrell hadn't remembered that the poster advertising the fight didn't say 8 rounds.
And I caught this typo, which advertised the fight as being a 10-round fight. And I said to Eddie Curry's manager, who was also a commissioner and also a guy with whom I had done business in italics before, well, we have 2 more rounds. And Eddie Curry refused.
As perhaps you'd have done if you'd been Eddie Curry. He'd done what he was paid to do, but Farrell, seeing an opportunity for a W where there had been none, persisted.
I said, no, this is a 10-round fight. You have to fight. Leon's ready to go. Round 9 starts in 1 minute. I'm looking at an imaginary watch.
Eddie Curry's manager tried to put his fighter's gloves back on, but it was no go.
He's not going to fight another second.
So Farrell suggested another route to the result that he and Spinks needed, a route where nobody would get hurt.
And so I said, look, we need to get the win. And his manager said, all right, but can we take care of this in the back room? And I said, yes.
The fight wasn't televised. Who was going to know?
All we need to do is phone it into the record book as a TKO win for Leon. As long as it's reported as that, that's what the record will say. And I don't care what the 300 people have seen. It's not going anywhere. And so we made a deal, and Leon got the win, and I wound up with Leon.
So rigging the record, that's another way to fix a fight. Charles Farrell once invented an entire career for a guy named John Carlo, who had never fought at all. It may seem unlikely that one of Charles Farrell's greatest regrets about his career in boxing involves a fight he didn't fix because he didn't think he needed to. Farrell's guy in that fight was a heavyweight named Mitch Green, and he came with baggage.
Well, there were actually a number of times that his career was sidelined by gunshot wounds, but a very specific one was just after I signed him to a contract. He got into an argument in the street about Mike Tyson. They had fought in the ring. They'd also fought on the street. And Mitch had lost a decision to Mike, which bothered him a lot. And someone talked to him about it. He got upset. He slapped the guy, and the guy went back into his house, got a gun, and shot Mitch right behind the knee, right in the femur.
Eventually, Mitch Green recovered, which turned out to be something of a mixed blessing for Farrell. He'd put Green up and supported him for 18 months. And then he arranged a fight that was supposed to launch Green's comeback. The fellow in the other corner was Bruce Johnson.
Bruce Johnson is one of these guys, and you see them often in boxing, who is a naturally good athlete, but understands that the way he can make money in boxing is to lose to name fighters. And it means that he goes into each fight trying to figure out what the easiest route out without taking an obvious dive is. And that's how he makes a living. So it doesn't serve his interest to be too good a fighter.
No wonder, then, that Farrell didn't bother fixing the Green-Johnson bout. Johnson knew his job. But had Farrell felt it was necessary to do some pre-fight business with Johnson's corner...
All I needed to add was one sentence. But the fight does not see the 3rd round. And he would have agreed to it. And as a matter of fact, he would have agreed to it happily. And I would have had a win for Mitch Green, which I desperately needed.
It didn't work out that way. When the bell rang, the 6'6", 250-pound Mitch Green stood idle in the center of the ring. Farrell thinks Green was upset that he wasn't getting enough attention and alludes to paranoia and a history of erratic behavior. In any case, Green listlessly absorbed Johnson's harmless punches. And after 2 rounds and several warnings, the referees stopped the fight because it wasn't a fight at all.
Well, I was furious. As a matter of fact, Mitch and I got into a shouting match at the hotel right after the fight because I'd spent what, for me at least, was a lot of money on him. More than that, I'd worked very hard to engineer his comeback.
Now there would be no comeback, and all because Charles Farrell hadn't thought it necessary to establish with all concerned before the fight that there was a script so basic that even the distracted, apparently disgruntled Green would have followed it.
Absolutely. I should have fixed that fight. It would have been one sentence. Yes.
As Mitch Green's impersonation of a mummy against Bruce Johnson suggests, managing boxers is not an entirely predictable way to make a living, even if you're adept at arranging results. And it can be risky. Farrell figured that out some years ago.
I also got involved with some really, really bad people for whom I was fixing fights. And some things didn't go our way. There were some mistakes made, which I corrected, and I can't really go into them. But these were dangerous people. And at one point, I was relatively sure that some harm was going to come to me. And I thought, I'm not a tough guy. Maybe it's time.
Charles, Richard Melito.
Hello, hello, hello.
Charles Farrell is now a jazz pianist who sometimes mixes messages from his answering machine into his compositions. This one's from the 2005 record Hope Springs Eternal. Farrell's essay, Why I Fixed Fights, is included in a new collection titled
Charles,
The Bittersweet Science.
Listen, I've been having a little problem on the North Carolina trip that Richie fought Chris. If I don't hear from you in 2 weeks, we'll have to resolve this in a different way. I really hope that we can resolve this the right way. I really don't want to go into this any further. I know you're in Puerto Rico, Chris told me. I mean, if I have to take a trip to Puerto Rico and we can discuss this, that's entirely up to you.
Born with dwarfism in 1915, Mace Bugin wasn't allowed to play sports, but near the end of his life, he was called on to give a speech. The topic?
Famous people I have met with scrapbooks and memorabilia.
That's just ahead, and don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Say the words baseball and poetry to most people, and they'll all smile and think about the same verse.
The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but one inning more to play. And so
yep, Casey at the Bat, performed by DeWolf Hopper in 1909. No poem set in a game has achieved the notoriety of Ernest Lawrence Thayer's doggerel, with which he tells the story of how the heroic Casey comes to the plate with a game on the line, lets two perfectly good strikes go by, and then whiffs, rendering Mudville joyless. DeWolf Hopper, an accomplished thespian, read the melodramatic verse in packed theaters. Some members of the audience recited along with him, others wept. Casey's charms have endured. He's the hero brought low. It's a dependable theme, and there's some suspense as the batters preceding Casey, the hapless Flynn and even less promising Blake, both reach base. Then Casey lets two strikes go by, setting up the climax of the poem. Though probably anyone should have been able to guess from the outset how that particular at-bat would turn out. I mean, Mudville. Casey plays for the Mudville Nine. How likely is it that a team from a town called Mudville would prevail? And then there's age. On that memorable day he stepped to the plate, Casey'd been around for a while. How else would he have established such a reputation?
Then from 5,000 throats went up a lusty yell. It rumbled in the valley, it rattled in the dell. It knocked upon the mountain top and recoiled upon the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat.
All of Mudville believed if Casey could but get a whack, they would go home triumphant. They might even forget for a moment that they lived in Mudville.
And when the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed in Casey's eye. A sneer curled Casey's lip.
So by the time the pathetic Flynn and undependable Blake reached base and Casey picked up the bat with which he intended to banish the gloom to which Mudvillians awoke each day, it felt heavy. His back probably hurt. Also his knees. In short, he was no longer the Casey of old. He was just old Casey. Ernest Lawrence Thayer may not have been a great poet, but he understood the nature of myth well enough to know that it's the fate of heroes to take on one too many dragons. Mr. Thayer draws Casey's flaw in capital letters. It's pride. He's overconfident. There is ease in his manner when he steps to the plate. There was no ease in the manner of Willie Mays when he stepped to the plate. And did Willie Mays ever sneer at the fellow on the mound? I think not. Casey's lucky the pitcher didn't start him off with a fastball in the ear. Instead, he gets strikes, hittable pitches, but Casey opts for drama.
Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. That ain't my style, said Casey. Strike one, the umpire said.
Casey waits until he has only one chance to lighten hearts in Mudville. By the time he exercises Christian charity toward the umpire by urging the fans not to go through with their murderous intentions against him, it's too late. God is shaking his head, though probably not sneering. What do you want, he or she is saying. I gave you two pitches to hit. Sit down, you bum, you. It makes a terrible kind of sense, just as tragedy is meant to do. And then the game ends, exactly when the poem does.
Mighty Casey has struck out.
Then I imagine Casey, baffled at his failure, probably slouches back toward the dugout. Maybe he'll hang on for another summer or two, but his salary will be cut. One day, as he's chasing a fly ball, he'll stumble like some old man tripped up by an uneven sidewalk. One fan in the near-empty bleachers will turn to another and say, "Geez, he should have quit a couple of years ago." Soon enough, Casey will be hanging at the Mudville taproom, telling his story for beers, insisting that the third strike was a spitball. Because Casey at the bat is not tragedy, it's pathos. And while it would be presumptuous to rewrite tragedy, that's not necessarily the case here, which explains why lots of people have offered alternative endings to the story. It's a temptation hard to resist.
The sneer is gone from Casey's lip. His teeth are clenched in hate. Alas, for what he might do next, it's suddenly too late. For Flynn, an absent-minded guy, a goofy sort of bird, has wandered from the base a bit and been picked off of third.
No? Okay. How about...
Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. But Mudville's gloom ain't permanent. Folks there have got it right. The fact that Casey let them down won't really change a lot. The nine of Mudville as a team, they've never been so hot. And whether they have lost or won, as dark gives way to dawn, the citizens of Mudville rise each day and soldier on.
As do the citizens of Pittsburgh, San Diego, Cincinnati, Kansas City, and so on. Baseball is in season again, and citizens have gathered in numbers to watch it, as they always do. Casey struck out. So did Babe Ruth and Willie Mays, and so do Miguel Cabrera and Bryce Harper, who'll get them next time until there is no next time, at which point somebody else will get them. It's the nature of the game. Have you subscribed to the Only a Game podcast yet? It's the best way to make sure you never miss our show. When we first heard about this next story, we weren't sure it was really about sports. After all, it's not about an athlete. It's not about a coach. But we found some reasons to go with it, and I hope you'll be glad we did. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
January 11th, 1976.
That's the voice of Mace Bugin introducing his own recording of a breakfast meeting of the Easton, Pennsylvania chapter of the B'nai B'rith, a Jewish service organization.
The guest speaker will be Mr. Morris Mace Bugin, whose topic will be Famous People. I have met with scrapbooks and memorabilia.
The tape cuts off and then picks up again at the breakfast. Mace is almost ready to start his talk.
Now, some of you fellows, like the doctor and a few others, if you want to push back, I can see your faces. I don't want to talk to the wall. I can see Cohen.
I went to enough small-town Rotary Club meetings as a kid to be able to visualize this room full of men dragging their chairs around to face the podium. But what's harder to picture is Mace Bugin, the man who has no problem barking orders at the members of the Easton B'nai B'rith and who stands just 43 inches tall.
I was born in Phillipsburg, New Jersey. That's across the Delaware River Bridge. On June 12, 1915.
Mace was the fourth of five children, born to Jacob and Sarah Bugin, Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. They owned a small grocery store. Within weeks of Mace's birth, the Bugins knew that there was something different about their son. Doctors figured it out pretty quickly. It was dwarfism. Doctors couldn't tell Jacob and Sarah how long their son would live. They couldn't do anything to straighten his crooked legs or fix the hump on his back. They suggested that the child should be put in an institution. But the Bugins were having none of that. They raised their son as a part of the community. He helped in the grocery store. He attended school. They had all the same expectations for him as they did for their other children. But even in the little town of Phillipsburg, New Jersey, his parents' high expectations could only take Mace Bugin so far. Teachers treated him as if he was incapable of learning. He wasn't allowed to play sports. So how is this a sports story?
So Mace always loved sports. He had two older brothers, and one of his older brothers, Phil, played on the football team in high school and then for Lafayette College.
That's Mace Bugin's grandniece. Her name is Gabrielle Kaplan Mayer.
And Mace was just, in those days, he wasn't able to play on any kind of team. I think it was always a painful thing for him that he couldn't be, as he said, the hero. And so he wanted to do something else to show that he was special.
In 1934, Mace was still in high school. Teachers had finally figured out that he should learn something while he was there, and so he stayed on for an extra year to catch up on everything he had missed. But his life was about to intersect with one of the most famous men of his age. Nearly 750 miles away from Phillipsburg, New Jersey, in Chicago, Illinois, boxer Joe Louis was preparing for his first professional fight. Mace loved boxing more than any other sport, and he decided he had to be there.
So he convinced his older brother, Phil, to take him to the, you know, bus station in Phillipsburg. His mother did not know anything about this. And I think it was kind of the way he was 19 years old that he really asserted his independence. He got on a bus bound to Chicago. The joke was that he paid the child's fare price. This was the Great Depression, and it was an overnight bus. And so the next morning, his stubble grew in, and the bus driver kind of gave him that look.
Mace had never gone anywhere without his family, and no one knows how he found his way from the bus station to the arena where Joe Louis was fighting. Kaplan Mayer says he didn't have a ticket. But no matter.
He would say he would walk through the legs of the tall people, and he went right down front to the first row. And when they brought Louis into the ring, Mace jumped under the ropes, ran up to him, kissed his gloves, and his famous quote was, "I want to wish you Jewish luck." They put Mace out of the ring. By that time, the crowd was cheering and cheering. They didn't throw him out. He got to stay. Watch the fight. Louis won.
Traveling across three states on the child's fare and sneaking into the front row might have been enough for most boxing fans, but it wasn't enough for Mace Bugin. He followed Joe Louis back to the locker room. Someone picked Mace up and placed him on the massage table right next to the boxer.
And Mace got his picture with Louis. It happened that this was all captured on the RKO newsreels, and Mace was seen all over the country.
When Mace got back home to New Jersey, he was a changed man. He knew what he could do to set himself apart, to let people know he was special. And it worked.
People from Phillipsburg didn't get on the RKO newsreel, so Mace became a celebrity. And he liked that people had seen him on the screen and perhaps looked at him differently. So Mace was hooked, and he bought a camera. Cameras were big. It was a lot to lug around. And he started staging his own photos with fighters and ballplayers. He got Joe DiMaggio.
Joe DiMaggio, Muhammad Ali, Meadowlark Lemon, Hank Aaron, Mario Andretti, Willie Mays, Bill Russell, plus actors, musicians, politicians. Mace even got a picture with Dr. Jonas Salk, the man who invented the polio vaccine. He never bought a ticket. He never asked permission. If they were giving out press credentials, he'd pretend to be a reporter. If there was a rope, he'd go under it.
He'd throw his camera at the closest reporter standing to him and say, "Hey, buddy, get my picture." And it all happened so quickly. Everyone was disarmed, and he would get his photos that way.
I mean, in a lot of these pictures, the subject looks startled.
Yes.
Mace looks like he's barking orders at someone.
Oh, yeah. But that's how he did it, you know. Mace just kind of inserted himself in those situations.
When Muhammad Ali was training in the Poconos, Mace loaded a group of teenagers into his car and took them on a quest to find Ali's training camp. Mace arrived in the middle of the night. Ali invited him in and made him breakfast. When New York Knicks star Walt Frazier wrote about Mace in his autobiography, Mace took another group of boys and stood outside the locker room, saying that he was going to sue Frazier for writing about him without his permission. Really, all he wanted was an autograph and a photo. But if he could make it onto the broadcast, that was even better. This one's from September 27th, 1950, when Mace jumped into the ring before another Joe Louis fight.
By the way, the action in the ring right now, as you see, is the midget who has come into the ring. And as he's in there, wandering across, the boys are saying, "Throw him out, throw him out."
They did throw Mace out of the ring, but again, they let him stay and watch the fight and get his picture. Mace Buguin took advantage of the fact that no one wanted to say no to the guy who was only 43 inches tall. And why wouldn't he?
He was constantly being disadvantaged, right, in not being able to participate in sports, in the way he was treated in school. The world was set up in a way that was just such a giant obstacle for him everywhere he went. And so if he could use his small size to any kind of advantage, he would do it. He had no issue with that.
If that had been all there was to it, this would just be a story about a man with differences who found the confidence to take on the world through his interactions, however brief, with famous athletes. And that would be fine. But this story is more than that. Because in the little town of Phillipsburg, where no one was famous, Mace Buguin owned a real estate and insurance business.
In his office, Mace was so smart. He had a bulletin board, and people in the community would stop by. You know, you'd stop by Mace's office every week to see what new photos he had. And you'd leave with a new insurance policy. That was part of Mace's business plan.
Mace Buguin, the 43-inch tall son of Eastern European immigrants, became a self-made millionaire. And that's the man who was invited to speak to the Easton Jewish Community Center chapter of the B'nai B'rith on January 11th, 1976.
Will you stand up, Gary, and tell the boys what happened with you and I one time?
A man named Gary stands up and tells the story of the night he and his father tagged along as Mace went to see Wilt Chamberlain. Pretty soon, the boys of the B'nai B'rith are swapping stories of the time Mace took them somewhere, or the time they were at the movie theater and Mace popped up on the big screen. No one mentions his size. Nobody says he did pretty well for himself in spite of his disadvantages. All the stories these men tell speak of generosity and the times Mace shared his brushes with celebrity, with generations of Lehigh Valley sports fans. When Mace Buguin died on October 31, 1982, who could deny that he had been special? For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Gabrielle Kaplan-Mayer has written a book about her great-uncle. It's called The Little Gate Crasher, The Life and Photos of Mace Buguin. We'll have a link and some of those photos at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from former boxing manager slash promoter Charles Farrell, who recalls his heated argument with heavyweight Mitch Green after Green refused to put up a fight against Bruce Johnson.
And at one point he said, "I'm going to punch you." And I said, "Well, we all know you can't punch." And that's when the police arrived, luckily for me.
Luckily indeed, because otherwise Charles might have had to talk with me through a wired jaw. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.